This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It used to be that salting meat or fish or curing it or smoking it was a way to preserve it when there was no other way to keep your meat safe over the lean period, back before we had refrigerators and industrial freezers and grocery stores with row upon gleaming row of vacuum-sealed meat in styrofoam trays. So I guess technically we have no real need for prosciutto or salami or ham or bacon. But come on. If it's not about need, today it's about desire, the sensuality of salty, rich, cured food, and it's about tradition and slow production and patience. Jeff Roberts admires those things, and he's written a new book called Salted and Cured, Savoring the Culture, Heritage, and Flavor of America's Preserved Meats. He lives in Montpelier and joins us today in the studio to talk about the history and modern delights of charcuterie. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Jane. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, it was a pleasure to read the book, although it made me both thirsty and hungry. So tell me a little bit about this renaissance of preserved meats.
You're supposed to read the book,
not eat it.
It is a renaissance. Up through, let's say, World War II, we had hundreds of small producers doing all sorts of things in which preservation is a key component. We lose all of it, or most of it, after the war, as America becomes industrialized with its food system. But there's still some people out there that are doing things that they had done for hundreds of years, both going back to the 17th century and then recent immigrants, recent meaning late 9th into the 20th century. And then a whole renaissance being driven by interests around great food, great beer, great wine that translates into people exploring the place of fermentation as a way to not only preserve things, but to create really unique flavors.
Can you talk a little bit about fermentation as it applies to cured meats? Because most of the time, you don't really like those two ideas to go together.
The best way to understand something like a cheese or a sausage, which a salami that has been fermented, is that it is it's considered controlled spoilage. Now, that was a really odd term for me when I first encountered it, and then I started thinking about it, and I said, you know, it makes sense. If it's uncontrolled, you don't eat it. The Chinese tease those of us in the West who eat cheese. They say that's rotten milk, and for them, for their tastes, that's very true. Fermentation for cured meats is principally in smaller items like a salami, for example, where you allow mostly lactobacillus varieties to do this wonderful work for you. With a whole muscle, for example, a prosciutto, it's the enzymatic work inside the muscle that makes that transformation. In both cases, salt is a primary component to that whole evolution because the things that are controlled, you control for the amount of water. Water is an ideal environment for all sorts of things to thrive, not just good things, but things that we don't want. So you want to reduce the amount of water, which makes an inhospitable environment for bacteria and other dangerous pathogens to thrive. You control for the amount of salt. And you also look for a level of acid, which again mitigates pathogenic development in either a whole muscle or a salami. So it is a very controlled, highly skilled approach, which literally over several thousand years, we figure out how to do and make the food not only delicious, but equally important, if not more important, that it's safe.
As you can see, listeners, Jeff Roberts knows what he's talking about, not just the science behind salted and cured, but also the stories behind these meats and the really unique treasures that you can find in America today and the story behind them. Jeff, how long ago did people start to discover and learn these methods for preserving meats?
Almost from the time that humans walked the earth. We have to. It's not something that we do because I want to be able to go into my pantry and find something delicious. I wanted to go into my pantry because that was the only source of food when those of us living in the northern hemisphere or in colder climates, we needed food for the winter. Or when food was scarce, what's in my pantry? So one of the things I discovered was the place of all of these unique techniques. Smoke is one of the first. Humans are living in caves. They have fire. Smoke rises to the roof of the cave, and they hung their meat up there. It helped to preserve them, also gave them pretty unique smoky flavor.
And kept the flies away, right?
And kept the flies away, yes. The Quechua people in the Andes were doing very unique things. They're the first ones to create freeze-drying, which most of us think about freeze-dried trail mixes mm-hmm. we can take out on our hiking trips. But they were freeze-drying potatoes several thousand years ago. The Inuit, when they would fish for salmon, they used the cold, dry wind to dry a butterflied fillet of salmon. It works. And we had to do this in order to survive. There's just no question that we wouldn't have survived as a species without those kinds of breakthroughs.
Now, even today, there are remarkable places around the world where you can find some of these specialty meats and some places where, you know, you can only find them because of designation of origin statutes. But your book is really about America's preserved meats. Nonetheless, you write in the book that the story of cured meat is really a story about immigrants. Explain.
Yes. Other than Native Americans, one of the things that the Quechua people teach other Native Americans, their word was charqui. They preserved animal flesh. That word gets translated by the Spanish to jerky. Native Americans are making venison or elk jerky, which they also discover they can pulverize and mix with animal fat and dried fruits, and they made pemmican, which is one of the most nutritious, energy-supplying foods anybody could ever eat. And explorers in the Antarctic and the Arctic took them with them. Our first European settlers into New England and the Middle Atlantic states brought preservation techniques, some of which relied on fermentation, but more often relied on smoke. So one of the companies that I researched, I was able to trace the current company's ancestors all the way back to Lancashire, England, 600 years of smoking and preserving meat. Those traditions, if we're looking at the first European introduced cured meat in the States, it will be country ham. Everybody did it. It was the way that you preserved for the wintertime, in the same way that up until the 1850s, we're making cheese on the farm because that was the way we preserved milk for the winter. As the Germans arrived, they brought an entirely different set of ideas because the climate in Germany was different. They couldn't ferment in the way that, let's say, the Italians might. So they use a lot more smoke, and much of the German wursts that were produced use smoke as a critical component or they are cooked. So charcuterie, which is the French term, salumi, the Italian term, is this very broad category, not just fermented, but also cooked or semi-cooked. Summer sausage is a cooked product and it lasts. So what we discover is that each succeeding wave, the Germans in places like New York, introduced all kinds of techniques. People loved it, not just the Germans. And then you have the arrival of Italians and Poles and Czechs, Hungarians, who not only in places like Boston and New York, but Cleveland and Chicago, and they're opening companies to make food similar to what they had at home. And for decades, that's how a lot of these companies thrived, buying pork from small farms that are local, even in New York City. They would just hop over the Hudson River to buy their raw materials to make great salami, great smoked wursts, whatever. That's still happening. We have immigrants that arrived after World War II from the Balkans, for example, who brought very different ideas. A lot of fermentation, a lot of smoke, considerable use of chilies in their products. And the first one that I visited in Astoria, Queens, I didn't want to leave. The aromas were so enticing. And it's the kind of building you'd sort of walk by and not really pay attention to. And wow, what a place.
Can I ask you one other question about history while we're talking about this? And I'm going to take us back a little farther, but also to the present. Are all wild hogs in the Americas today here because of colonization and because of the importance of having pork and cured meat? I mean, you talk about explorers basically dropping off pigs and then they're allowed to go feral. And I'm curious if all of our wild hogs these days can be descended from those that were dropped off.
There, when we look at hog species, that very large family. There are some animals in the Western Hemisphere who are related, but they're not hogs the way we understand them. The Spaniards bring them with them, and they left them on islands because they knew they were coming back, and they had a ready food supply. It's really brilliant, you know. Let them go and eat. They'll reproduce, and there'll be a food supply when we get here. Hernan de Soto, when he was looking for the Fountain of Youth, lands in Florida and brings pigs with him, which basically traveled with his expedition. They needed meat. It was there. De Soto introduces hogs to Native Americans who all of a sudden, wow, there's this entirely new, rapidly reproducing food stuff that we're enjoying. In New England, what happens is that they weren't fenced. In the animals go out into the forest and they forage. They eat everything, and they get big. Wall Street, when it was a wall, was put up because there were so many hogs on Manhattan Island that they had to fence them out. Remarkable, in my opinion. I do want to say one thing that as I'm describing what happens, and I'll come back to your question about these feral hogs. Humans have had a yin-yang history with hogs. The pig is nature's most efficient converter of food to muscle and fat. There is maybe, except for maybe insects. Other than that, this is the one. They're clean. If they're kept on a farm, they will create one place where they go to the bathroom. They never do anything else there because they're that sanitary. And people say, well, they're dirty animals. They wallow. And there's a reason for this. Just like a dog, they don't have sweat glands. And in order for them to stay cool, they're either under a canopy or they wallow. Dust helps to keep parasites off of the skin. So inherently, they're not an animal that's dirty. We have figured out how they can do any number of things for us as a species, some of us are repelled by. But they're not a dirty animal by nature. those animals that were let loose, that's how we grew them for a long time. And mm-hmm. the way that we would then harvest them is during the course of the growing season, a farmer would every night put a little bit of corn out near the fence. The animals always knew that there was something there to eat and they would come back. So at the end of the season, they would be there and they could then be corralled and then sent to slaughter. The animals were eating in the fall everything that dropped from the trees, nuts of all kinds, which are referred to as mast, mm-hmm. M-A-S-T. Mm-hmm. So acorns, pecans, any beech nuts, they convert those nuts and all those beautiful oils and flavors into flesh and fat. That's part of what flavored them.
Go ahead.
So today, the sad thing is that feral animals are everywhere. There are some in Vermont.
Oh, now you're starting a controversy, Jeff. That's a whole other show.
It is. But there are. And they appear to have escaped from some of these hunting reserves. What happens is that the animal almost immediately begins to revert back to what it was naturally. That's part of what we've seen in the southern states.
And you write in the book that in the southern states in particular, you know, these feral hogs can be real nuisances. I mean, really big problems in some parts of this country. But they're often now appearing or starting to appear on some menus that,
yes.
that there is even cured meats that are coming from feral hogs, which is a way to, you know, to help take care of this problem. But you also talk about how breeders are starting to breed pigs that have better flavor. And yeah. part of that is pigs that are not so lean. You know, for a while in this country, we were leaning towards lean pork. You know, this was supposed to be the other white meat. And producers of bacon and ham and all of these other wonderful preserved meats that you talk about are saying, these don't taste good. Give us pigs that taste good. And I'm curious if the feral hogs that are on the menu, aren't they lean because they've been out in the forest?
Generally, they're not
because
they basically are out there foraging on whatever they find. And they're in places where there are forests in places like Texas or the Carolinas. They're in both forest and farmland and they eat everything. You know, if the farmer has planted a field of corn, it's almost impossible to keep the animals out.
That's the problem.
That's the part of the problem. So the financial loss to farmers in many states today is really considerable. So they are hunted. They're not you're not allowed by law to shoot an animal and then send it to a restaurant. They have to be trapped and then kept in quarantine for a period of time. Everything looks good. Then they can be sent to a USDA certified slaughterhouse. And then they show up on menus as wild boar. We don't eat enough wild boar to make a dent in the population, but it is a direction that we are headed. And it's something, when we think about nuisance plants and animals, most of these we can eat.
We're talking to Jeff Roberts. He's the author of Salted and Cured, Savoring the Culture, Heritage, and Flavor of America's Preserved Meats. I promise we'll stop talking about feral hogs, and we're going to talk about some of the wonderful food you can eat and all of the places that Jeff visited in researching this book. And let's go to Michael, who's calling in from Windsor. Hi, Michael. Go right ahead.
Hello, Jamie, Jeff. This is Michael from Windsor. And I wondered if Jeff could comment on the cured meat called soup.
Soupy.
Yes.
Yeah, Jeff, now you recognize it?
Yeah, this is the name that the Fortuna Company that's based out of Sandgate, Vermont, they produce. They gave it this name. It's a type of soppressata. And one of the things is that you find soppressata all the way through Italy. It's what makes them different are the types of grinds, from coarse to very fine, how they're flavored, whether some of them actually include small chunks of fat as part of the recipe. The soupy is just that's a trademark name by the Fortuna Company. Fabulous sausage, the salami, to say the least. And it's great. Even though it's manufactured now outside of the state, the company is still, Patty Fortuna Standard is still doing some wonderful stuff, inventing new recipes all the time.
Oh, sounds wonderful. Let's hear from Jenneth calling in from Springfield. Hi, Jenneth. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Great. What are you thinking?
I have a couple of quick questions and a real brief minor correction. It was Ponce de Leon who was looking for the Fountain of Youth. Soda was looking. He's so-called discovered the Mississippi River, but I think he discovered it for the Europeans and not for native peoples. My question is, give me some idea about how peppers and other spices were used in the East really early on, far before the Europeans.
Peppers and spices in curing meats, you mean?
Yeah, the spices were very important, and they were part of the Silk Road that was set, that came out of Turkey and came out of other Eastern countries. Salt was important, as usual, but the pepper and other spices were used for something. I thought they were for preserving. It might be for something else, and I'm curious about that.
Great question. First of all, spices have been a commodity and a currency for thousands of years. So when you use the word pepper, I believe what you're referring to here is black pepper. What we too often refer to as pepper when we're in a supermarket is the bell pepper, which is actually a member of the chili family coming out of the Americas, not discovered until 500 years ago. What happens with the use of a variety of spices, most of which are from Asia, Southeastern Asia, and the Pacific Islands, they are not used so much as preservatives. They can be. The critical one would have been black pepper, but combined with salt. So one way that some of these spices were used as preservatives was in Egypt, not for something to eat. We use them to preserve mummies. So the use of spices, honey, for example, as a curing agent. We should be so lucky. You know, some of the mummies, I just saw something this morning. They just discovered a 3,800-year-old tomb, perfectly preserved mummies. And we should be so lucky that I-89 lasts 3 years, let alone 3,000 years. Fascinating story about how spices have a critically important role in the preservation of many different things. So that's so what happens in...
Well, I guess we should remember we are meat after all.
Oh, yeah. And they did some very odd things with some of these spices. It's this exchange, especially of chili, when it arrives with the Spaniards to Europe, that you begin to see some very exciting changes in how salamis and other cured meats are flavored. Yes, they do have the ability to repel insects. So some of the country hams in the States, they used a black pepper mix to keep the flies away from the meat. So thank you. And you're right. DeSoto was the guy who crossed the southern U.S., eventually ends up in Arkansas, finds all of these unique places. It's a 3-year expedition.
Imagine that today. You know, I was thinking, Jeff, as I read your book and you talked about salami and Lebanon bologna and all of these things that I kept remembering back to my childhood in the 1980s. And, you know, my experience with some of what you talk about in the book was processed bologna. And, you know, my stepfather made me a sandwich every single day that was a slice of really kind of gross bologna with a squirt of yellow mustard sandwiched between two slices of white bread. How far away from that are we today in the places that you were researching?
Well, that's still there. That size of sandwiches still exist.
You know, and probably today I would love it, I have to say, but not every day. It got old.
Bologna picks up its name from the city of Bologna. And mortadella, which is the, in a sense, the ancestor. This is a finely almost emulsified meat. Again, I'm looking for ways that I use every part of an animal. I cannot afford to discard something if I can figure out a way to make it safe and to eat it. So with many of the pieces of scrap, they're emulsified with fats. They're cooked. Now, with a mortadella, true mortadella has these wonderful little cubes of fat embedded in it. And the best also have these fabulous pistachios from Sicily also embedded in it. You compare the two and this is really day and night.
Mm-hmm.
Our hot dogs today don't at all reflect what we had historically, although there's a renaissance of hot dog production,
mm-hmm.
With using real natural casings. So, you know, even Nathan's from Coney Island, all beef, but a casing that was beef. So anybody could eat it. There were no religious issues around that. And it snapped when you bought
when you bit into it.
Yes. That sort of thing is something that we're now rediscovering. There's all of these new hot dog companies who are talking about creating artisan hot dogs. I celebrate this because it's reintroducing both the techniques and the tradition, but also the flavors. And in order to do something, if they're going to create an expensive hot dog, they're moving away from the use of commodity hogs, which is also a theme that runs throughout the book, is what we've done since the late 1960s to create the other white meat. And when we say the other white meat, that was a contrast to everybody suddenly eating chicken, which up through World War II, nobody ate. And all of a sudden, everybody wants to eat chicken, and the hog gets pushed to the side. America is built on hogs, not beef. If you could afford it, you ate something that was pork. If you could really afford it, then on occasions you would have beef. But beef doesn't really show up as a main part of our diet until after World War II, when we could then afford far more. The place of the war and the Depression and our inability to purchase things after the war, I don't want those restraints anymore. I want to eat, and I want to eat a lot.
Yes, and on to today. Again, Jeff, you're coming up with another show for us to do, and one we have before, this idea of I want to eat a lot, certainly an issue in America. Nicole writes, I recently went to Hungary to learn how to preserve meat. It was eye-opening how much of a tradition this is becoming in the U.S., even on a small-scale farm, a trend I've also witnessed in Vermont with the professionalization of butchering. Jim says, I run Cherry Rail Farm in Brattleboro, where I raise pasture-raised pigs. To me, pasture-raised means the woods where the pigs eat, just as feral pigs would have for centuries. The meat is amazing because they are allowed to roam and forage. And let's get a call in here from Bill in Hinesburg. Hi, Bill. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jeff. It's good to hear your voice. I have a question. It's perhaps a little dark, but I remember I'm a great fan of charcuterie and also of your books. I remember reading many years ago, though, about smoked meat, and they had done a study in the Georgian Republic where it's very, very commonly eaten, and a very, very high incidence of stomach cancer. Can you comment at all on, you know, any possible relationship between smoked charcuterie and stomach cancer?
Well, my response, Bill, would be that there's clearly evidence about the role of smoke, whether we're talking barbecue, whether we're talking cured meats and other things that we like smoke in, where there seems to be a somewhat higher incidence of cancer. I'm going to take your question and twist it around a little bit because it's not there's something we haven't talked about, and that's the whole role of nitrates and nitrites as a preservating as a preservatives in cured meats.
And you have a gripe about this.
And I do have a gripe about it. So the definition between a cured meat and an uncured meat is that the USDA defines nitrates and nitrites, something like, say, a pink salt, which is a preservative salt, that's synthetic. And if you use that in your process, you have to indicate that this is cured. That's the only term you're allowed to use. And you have to show that there are nitrates and nitrites in your process. Uncured means that I can still use products that contain nitrates and nitrites, but they're not synthetic. So there's a whole batch of vegetables. Celery, and I'll just pick on that one right now, celery is one of them. You and I, even if we're vegetarians, we eat a lot of vegetables and they're loaded with nitrates naturally. My gripe is that when I look at a package that says uncured bacon, for example, somewhere in that label there will be a little footnote, except the nitrites found in naturally occurring sea salt or celery salt. Well, I think we should be a lot more transparent. This is not the producer's problem as much as it is how the USDA has defined some of this. And in my opinion, that's confusing consumers. I'd like them to understand that the place of a preservation chemical, if used appropriately, does the right thing in the same way that the use of celery salt does the right thing. And the evidence that comes out of a lot of research shows, and this is now 20 to 25-year-old evidence, the ingestion of nitrates and nitrites are not cancer-causing in any way, shape, or form. The evidence that I saw from Canada, from the U.S., consumers should be far less concerned. There are a lot more things, in my opinion, are at high risk.
You know, Jeff also goes into detail in the book about some of the other ways that regulations that are put in place to make sure that we have food safety in this country also in some ways maybe curtail the ability for producers to make some of the meats that they would really like to make or to make them in the way that they would like to make. And we don't have time to get into that today, Jeff. But just before I let you go, it seems like a lot of the U.S. production, at least large scale, is in the South. And you write lovingly of some visits that you made to places like Louisiana. But is there anything happening in Vermont? Is this something that we are enjoying as well here?
We are beginning to see more. There's a fair amount being done in restaurants. It's a different level of inspection. It doesn't mean that what they have to go through is less rigorous, but they can sell direct. They can do stuff on premises. There are several companies now, some of which are working out of the Mad River Food Hub, one here in Montpelier, Bow, that has started its own line of charcuterie that they will be wholesaling. This is exciting. Biggest challenge, in my opinion, is probably finding the right animals at a sufficient level of quantity to be able to do this.
Well, you know, it's still emerging, so maybe we'll get there and we can see, you know, the second edition of your book in 10 years, see if you've had to adjust some of your numbers on the hogs. Jeffrey P. Roberts is the author of Salted and Cured, Savoring the Culture, Heritage, and Flavor of America's Preserved Meats. Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, and thank you all for calling in or sending in messages.
Coming up, the sun is out. You probably want to get out into nature, but the mud may have other plans. We'll talk hiking in mud season next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Spring, when a Vermonter's fancy turns to hiking in the great outdoors. The great outdoors, however, may have other plans. Yes, friends, it's mud season. And if you do want to get out there and hike, there are some things you should keep in mind. Here to tell us about some of them is Kristen McLean from the Green Mountain Club. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, we all know what mud season is. We get it. Spoiler alert, there's mud. But can you actually give us the science? Why do we get mud season?
So the reason mud season happens is as spring arrives and the snow starts melting, the ground starts thawing, and, you know, April showers, it starts raining a lot, that just the combination of all of that moisture and precipitation, the ground can't handle it. So it becomes oversaturated. It just can't absorb any water, so mud puddles just appear everywhere. There's, you know, there's standing water on the ground. And what that does to the ground, if people actually try to hike through the mud on the trails, is it causes damage to the trail and to the surrounding environment. So when people hike on oversaturated trails, they cause soil compaction, and that degrades the quality of the trail because it reduces its ability to absorb water. And when it can't absorb water, that increases the flooding later, and it makes it harder for vegetation to grow. And then when vegetation can't grow and hold the soil in, erosion starts to carry the soil away, and that leaves rocks and roots exposed. And it's just kind of compounding damage. Just more and more flooding occurs.
Okay, but, you know, I got good boots, and I'm just going to walk around. The trail is muddy. I'm going to walk on the grass where it's a little bit less muddy off the trail. Good solution?
That is actually not a great solution. So when people try to, you know, obviously you want to avoid a mud puddle. You don't want to get you or your gear wet and dirty. But when you walk around the muddy area, it tramples the vegetation, it widens the trail, and it causes more damage to the trail and the environment.
So how serious is this damage to the trails that you're talking about? Because we have this cycle every year, and then it dries out and the trails seem fine. You know, is the damage that you're talking about reversible?
It is reversible, but it is still pretty serious damage. So you might know that our trails are maintained by some professional trail crews here at Green Mountain Club. And, of course, the State Park and Green Mountain National Forest maintain their trails as well. But it's also maintained by a lot of volunteers. So it can take hours for a volunteer or trail crew to fix what takes just minutes to damage by hiking on these muddy trails. So each footstep kind of makes extra work for those people who we already have other major projects planned for them this year. So when they have to clean up after mud season, that kind of takes time away from the other projects.
But Kristen, it's April. It's beautiful. It's been snowing for months. It's been freezing cold. Mm-hmm. Are you saying we now should not be going out on the trails during this wonderful, beautiful spring season? What are we supposed to do? What are our dogs supposed to do?
Well, I totally get where you're coming from. I mean, we have spring fever just as much as everyone else, and we love hiking at the Green Mountain Club. So what people should keep in mind is that just because it's warm and dry at the trailhead, that doesn't necessarily mean that's what it's going to be like farther up the trail. You could still be walking into winter if you somehow made it past the mud without damaging the trail. There was just a rescue in New Hampshire this weekend where some folks went out in shorts and sandals because it was 70 degrees, and they managed to get up over some ice, but then they called for a rescue when they couldn't get back down. So there is a safety issue. There are also other activities that you could do in the spring. You could go cycling on your bike. You could go paddling on a kayak or canoe. There's road walking. And actually, here at Green Mountain Club, we have an outings calendar on our website where you can join all of these type of outings with some of our different Green Mountain Club sections.
You also do have advice for people who, you know, want to go out and find trails, but also want to be responsible stewards and responsible hikers. And there are some tips that you have for either specific trails or types of trails to look for.
Yeah, so if you really, you know, can't resist the call of the trail, you need to get out there. We ask that people stick to lower elevations and south-facing slopes. Those tend to dry out a little bit earlier in the season. But we still really need people to just be flexible. So like I said, if you show up at the trailhead, it may look a certain way. Once you get a little ways into your hike, it might start to look different. So we just ask people to be willing to turn around if the trail becomes muddy. Just one of the leave no trace principles for outdoor ethics is to only travel on durable surfaces, and mud is not durable. So we just really ask people to be ready to turn around. There are plenty of places you can still hike in mud season. there are recreation paths. There's one in Stowe. There's one in Burlington. There are tons of back roads that you can walk on. You can still be in the woods. If you really want to gain some elevation, one option for that is Mount Escutney in Windsor, because you can hike up the Otter Road, and there's still plenty of views from there. And there are some other mountains with Otter Roads, like Mount Philo in Charlotte. So these are all great options for getting outside, where you're not going to be on trails that you can damage.
And which trails tend to dry out first?
Well, the trails that are lower elevation in hardwood forests, those tend to dry out much sooner. And south-facing slopes of the mountains also dry out much, much sooner than the north-facing slopes. So if you can kind of stick to those areas. Now, you can always call the Green Mountain Visitor Center, and that's 802-244-7037, and you can get an update on some of your trails, because we try to keep up to date with what they're looking like. And Vermont State Parks this year is also doing a trail update weekly on their website. So they're going to list which of their trails are open and closed as of that week. And also keep in mind that they do close some trails officially. The Mount Mansfield and Camel's Home trails are all closed from now until Memorial Day.
You know, one other question I have for you, Kristen, that, you know, it may be a little bit less intuitive about mud season, but it can actually be kind of a dangerous time for forest fires. So if people are hiking and maybe camping, any thoughts on how to be aware of the surroundings beyond just the mud on the ground? You know, the leaves may still be quite dry.
Yes, and that is always an issue once the snow cover melts. You don't have that protection from fire anymore. So people should really minimize their campfire impacts and maybe just don't have a fire at all if you're, you know, going to be out there camping, because there is a lot of dry tinder and, you know, sticks and leaves and stuff left on the ground now that the snow has melted. So it would be best just not to have any fires at this point.
Kristen McLean is Membership and Communications Coordinator for the Green Mountain Club. Kristen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
In addition to mud, there is another sure sign of spring, the ephemeral sound of peepers. These tiny frogs are just an inch long, and they thrive near wetlands and vernal pools. In late afternoon and evening, male peepers create a high-pitched chorus of mating calls that can get really loud despite coming from such small creatures. Just next to our studios in Colchester, there's a large stormwater retention pond surrounded by tall reeds and woods. Here's the sound we've been hearing when we step outside in the evening. Singing right outside the VPR studios in Colchester, Vermont. And that's our show for today. If you have a comment you'd like to share, leave us a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us at Vermont Edition. And follow Vermont Edition in NPR One for our latest content. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Jake Rusnak directed this program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.